NBC News Radio, I'm Mike Vaccara at the White House. The former Libyan intelligence officer convicted of the 1988 Lockerbie, Scotland bombing that killed 270 people has died. His brother said on Sunday he was 59 years old. Abdel Basset al-Megrahi died at home after a long battle with cancer. His health had deteriorated quickly, his brother told Reuters today. NATO leaders are in Chicago to map their exit from Afghanistan in 2014 while still spending billions to prop up the country's security and police services. Thousands are planning to protest later today while three demonstrators were arrested early this week and charged with terrorism conspiracy. The attorney for the accused, Michael Deutsch, is speaking out.
An entrapment to the highest degree, the so-called incendiary devices and the plans to attack police stations, attack the mayor's office, is all coming from the mind of the police informants.
This is NBC News Radio. Hurricane season doesn't start for another 2 weeks, but we've already got activity in the Atlantic. Weather Channel meteorologist Chris Warren reports Tropical Storm Alberto is about 100 miles offshore.
It is southeast of Charleston and Savannah, Georgia. Already seeing some of that rain along the South Carolina coast.
A tropical storm watch continues along a stretch of South Carolina coast today. Maximum sustained winds are 50 miles an hour. A strong earthquake has rocked a large swath of northern Italy.
The quake in Italy has killed at least four people and injured dozens, many of whom were working overnight shifts. It also seriously damaged several historic buildings, such as churches, bell towers, and the 14th century Estense Castle in the town of San Felice sul Panaro. The U.S. Geological Survey website says the 6.0 magnitude quake was centered 22 miles north-northwest of Bologna. It hit at about 4 in the morning and was felt as far west as Liguria on the border with France. Scott Carr, NBC News Radio.
More news at MSNBC.com. I'm Mike Vaccara, NBC News Radio.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly. To protect your engine, you have to change the oil. Right now at O'Reilly Auto Parts, pick up Mobil Super Conventional Motor Oil for $2.99 a quart or High Mileage for $3.49 a quart. Protect against sludge and wear with Mobil Super Conventional or High Mileage Motor Oil at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. Limit supply, see store for details.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Whether you're looking to buy a home or repair the one you're in, at Wells Fargo, we're with you. The Wells Fargo Home Lending website has the tools and resources to help you make informed decisions. There are many home lending options to consider, and we'll help you understand the benefits, financial considerations, and next steps. We can also help you find coverage if you're looking to insure your home. Stop by today or go to wellsfargo.com/homelending to learn more. Wells Fargo. Together, we'll go far. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A., all rights reserved, equal housing lender. Insurance products are not FDIC insured, are not bank.
At the Jeep brand, we've been on active duty for over 70 years, in conditions you can imagine and some you can't. And like our soldiers, we never shy away from a challenge. So we'd like to honor our Armed Forces outstanding service during the Jeep military event. Get $1,000 total military bonus cash toward a new 2012 Jeep vehicle. After so much time in service to others, we're giving our soldiers the recognition they deserve. Jeep.
Plus, right now, get 0% APR financing on the 2012 Jeep Compass and Jeep Patriot. Offer available to active military, military reserve, retired military, and retired military reserve with honorable discharge and 20 years of service within 6 months of discharge date on a retail purchase or lease. Excludes SRT models. See dealer for details. Financing for well-qualified buyers through Ally Financial. Not all buyers will qualify. Must take retail delivery by 5/31/12. Jeep is a registered trademark of Chrysler Group, LLC.
Adobe Acrobat Pro is actually used very commonly for PDF archiving. If you've got a lot of files of different formats and different types, if you just save these files into all these different formats, then 20 years later, somebody wants to look at the file, they'd actually have to have the program that could open up that file. So for digital archiving, you'd rather have a standardized file format.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
The men and women of our National Guard and Reserve Forces are working hard on the battlefield and here at home. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve is working just as hard for them. For over 36 years, ESGR has paved the way for greater understanding between our Guard and Reserve Forces and their civilian employers, promoting a culture where all American employers support and honor the military service of their employees. Together, we all serve. To learn more, visit www.esgr.mil.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. I'm Peter Schwartz, your host, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Alera, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Susan Neely, who's the president and CEO of the American Beverage Association, Christopher Brown, founder and chairman of Christopher Consultants, Mike Primo, the president and CEO of Airlines Reporting Corporation, and finally Dan Frank, the CEO and managing partner of Three Wire Systems. First up is a young lady by the name of Susan Neely, who's the president and CEO of the American Beverage Association. What is the American Beverage Association, Susan?
Better known as the trade association representing the non-alcoholic beverage industry like Coke, Pepsi, Dr. Pepper, Nestle Water, and all our brands.
Why a trade association? Why do these companies need somebody like this?
Better together when it comes better to together. Representing yourself before Congress or a governor or a state legislature or a city council. So there's strength in numbers.
Great. When was the organization founded?
About 93 years ago.
93 years ago.
Of course,
ago.
We were called the National Soft Drink Association then, but now we're American Beverage to reflect all the diversity of products.
Uh-huh. And how big or small is the association today?
Well, we're considered a larger trade association in Washington. We have about a $60 million operating budget, so... We're good size.
When did you join the organization?
I've been the CEO for the last 7 years.
And you were hired as the CEO?
I was indeed.
Why are you the ideal pick?
I've been there. I've been in the White House. I worked in Congress. I worked in the Cabinet Department. I worked in the governor's office. I worked for a congressman. So I know how policy is made and how decisions are made, and that's what they wanted.
Well, that's the role. Why are you ideally suited?
Well, I think it helps to have somebody who's very tuned into the key consumer group that's also driving policy in this country, and that would be women. And helps to be a mom because I kind of know how our group thinks about not just the products but policy.
And you are, in fact, the first woman CEO of this association?
Yes, I am.
So congratulations. What's it like to be the first woman CEO?
It's terrific. It's a great group. These are among the most valued brands in the world. They are exquisitely tuned in to how their consumers think. They want to be on the leading edge, so it's a great privilege to be there.
So take us back. Where are you from?
I am an Iowa girl, grew up in a college town where the University of Iowa is, Iowa City. Go Big Ten, go Hawkeyes, and came to Washington to work for my congressman.
Why?
Because I liked politics, I liked policy, but what I really wanted to be was have your job and be a radio broadcaster. So I came out here, my college advisor said, well, while you're distributing your audition tapes across the Eastern Seaboard, maybe you shouldn't get a job. And so I started as a receptionist for my congressman. Loved the whole environment so much, I never distributed a single audition tape. I stayed in politics.
And I'll bet you didn't stay receptionist for very long. You had to do something else.
I spent the whole summer, the first 3 months on the job, volunteering for all the legislative assistants and the press secretary to do anything. And after 3 months, I got promoted to Cub legislative assistant and Cub press secretary.
So then what happened?
Well, I loved that advocacy arena, went back to my home state after a few
years. What is it
about
the advocacy arena that's so interesting to you?
I like packaging ideas and convincing people of things.
Where did that first start showing up?
You know, that started showing up as a little kid when I thought everybody should do it my way. So I've just gotten more artful about that over the years. But I think my family will tell you that I always had an idea for everybody. Some might say often wrong, but never in doubt. But
So advocacy. Keep going.
So advocacy is what I wanted to do. And I went back to my home state then and worked for a guy who was running for governor, very young man, 35 years old. My dad said he will never win. Of course, he not only won as governor, he served for 16 years, and he's had a little hiatus and is governor again today, Terry Branstad. So
you proved your father wrong?
I did, and he told me that many times, but it was a coming-of-age moment where I said, Dad, I don't agree with you. I'm going to do this, and was proven to be
made a wise choice. So is that another attribute of Susan Neely, this idea of believing in something and just doing it?
Well, I will credit my father with the making sure I thought that way. You know, as a lawyer, he had the Socratic method of raising kids. He didn't tell you no. He just kept asking questions till he revealed the flaws in your own position. So the key was to learn how to beat him at his own game and always have thought through the next question and the answer, and the next question and the answer.
What were dinner conversations like growing up?
You know, my brother would agree. He was trained in the Socratic method, so we were always trying to beat Dad at his game. And I remember clearly when I was 16 that I finally forced him to use illogic to defend a position. And my brother has a similar story. So that was how we were raised.
So what were you doing prior to your current position?
I actually had been in the private sector and then answered the call to return to public service after September 11th, 2001.
That's a great story, so tell us about it.
So I got a call from an old friend who said, you've been whining for 10 years that you were missing public service. I know Tom Ridge. He's looking for someone to come into the White House and run communications in this new entity called Homeland Security. I think you should go talk to him. And I will be forever grateful that I had an old friend give me a push and the opportunity to do that.
So what was it like to be involved at that moment in history?
It's hard to describe just how chaotic and tense and meaningful every day was. We were all thrown into empty nooks and crannies in the White House and in the old executive office building. We were making up something on the fly with the whole world watching. Everybody had an opinion. Everybody was criticizing it. But it was just such important work, and you had a great sense of privilege every day that you showed up on the job.
I can imagine just dozens of people chomping at the bit to be able to do that. Why did they pick you?
We had a mixture of people with private sector and public sector and military and intelligence experience. I actually think that I knew how a governor's office worked. I knew how Congress worked. I knew how complicated communication systems work was an asset, because I could put that all together. And I obviously had to learn the Homeland Security arena, but I had a good skill set for what was needed.
Well, that's, go ahead.
The White House is such a time black hole, and you mentioned that, you know, how it affected your family in both ways. Why don't you tell that story?
There's no question anybody that works in any White House, their family makes a sacrifice with them, and it was one of the reasons I almost didn't take the job was because of the impact on the family. I had we had just adopted a baby from Cambodia, May 2001. And when September 11th happened, I was so struck by the risk to our value system as a country, and the thought that the kind of country that opens its arms to a child like my son from another world, that kind of thing could be in jeopardy. So the reason not to go to the White House was the children, because of the impact on them, but also the reason to go and join in this big mission was the children, and ultimately, I'll be forever grateful I did.
Well, running a trade association is a little bit different than running a business, and you have prominent employers, but they won't always do what you say. How did you find yourself able to handle that?
Well, it's a great merging of skill sets, because I was in business. I ran a subsidiary of Young and Rubicam here in Washington, and so I understand how business thinks and works. And I understand also how to build consensus because of all my time in government. So actually, that's the perfect skill set. I find the intersect between the business agenda and the policy agenda and then lay that out in the way that CEOs make decisions.
So how do you spend the bulk of your day in your current job?
I like to say I spend a lot of time, along with colleagues, building the case in every way.
You're still having the conversation with Dad?
Data, analysis, messaging, and making the case. You build the case and you make the case, and that's a pretty complicated, but that's it in a nutshell.
What's it like to lead a company, an organization of this size?
It's a privilege. It's heady. It's exciting. I've wanted to be a CEO. I didn't even know what that was since I was 2 years old. And so this is just a great position for me because it pulls together everything that I know how to do.
What surprised you most when you took over the reins?
I was surprised at how complicated my members' organizations are. I think it's a myth that they decide things unilaterally. They're big, complicated, multinational companies. And so what we would say is absolutely the right thing to do from a policy standpoint here in the U.S. or even North America has huge implications for the business in China and India and South America and the EU. And so all that has to get put together in the C-suite of these companies, and they the chairman have input from their business units all over the world as they're evaluating what to do in our arena. And that complexity is an interesting part of it, but it's also makes it harder to get consensus.
Where do you want to lead this group? Because it's not quite like leading a company where you're looking at your bottom line and growing. So where do you want to lead this group?
The key to leadership in the trade association world is that you are seen as a leader in your policy space. So if you make food or beverage for a living, what are the big issues of the day? It's your packaging, it's your water stewardship, it's health, nutrition. Are we playing a role in fighting obesity? The great thing about representing some of the most valuable brands in the world is they want to be leaders. So our job is to figure out how to put them as leaders in all of those issue areas.
Is your father aware of your success?
Well, my father's passed away, but I'm confident he knows what's happening. He certainly was there to have a couple meals in the White House mess when I worked at the White House, and he really enjoyed that.
Great. What's the website address?
www.amerabev.org.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Susan Neely, who's the president and CEO of the American Beverage Association. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Alera, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Rick Palmer.
Rick, who are you with?
I'm the Vice President of Business Development with Integrity Management Consulting.
What is Integrity Management Consulting?
Integrity is a rapidly growing small business here in McLean, and we're proud to be ranked as one of the top fastest growing companies in the local area and in the state of Virginia.
What kind of work do you do, in just a few words?
We do acquisition planning and program management support.
For the federal government?
For the federal government.
Okay. Now, you're not here really to talk too much about what Integrity does. You're here to do some celebrating. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
What are you celebrating?
Well, we've just been named one of Virginia's Fantastic 50 Companies for 2012. We're one of the fastest growing companies in the state of Virginia, and we're going to be receiving that award very shortly.
Tonight?
Yes.
Fantastic. You're also one of the seven precious jewels?
Yes, we were just named one of Consulting Magazine's seven small jewels for 2012 as one of the fastest growing companies in the area.
But we're not done yet, are we?
No, absolutely not.
There was one more thing you were going to celebrate.
We have a good nationwide presence, and particularly in the southwestern United States. We've just opened a field office in Fort Worth, Texas, where a lot of our business is.
You're able to accomplish all these things because you're able to focus and compete effectively in a full and open environment. How are you able to do that, in a few words?
Well, how we're able to do that is just the fact that we evolved our company very, very quickly. The founders and the owners did that, and quite honestly, we just did not attempt to do all things all at the same time. Focused on some great areas and built the business where we could.
We've been speaking with Rick Palmer of Integrity Management Consulting, and that was your business spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Alera, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. We're broadcasting today from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. And it's my pleasure to introduce Chris Brown, who's the founder and chairman of a company called Christopher Consultants. What is Christopher Consultants, Chris?
Well, Christopher Consultants is a civil engineering, land planning, surveying, landscape architecture firm. We have about 107 employees as of the last payroll. It does go up and down from time to time. And we provide civil engineering services for land development and public infrastructure in the Washington-Baltimore region. We also provide some services internationally, although that's a small part of our business.
When was the company founded?
1982, September of 1982.
So 30 years.
30 years, yes, sir.
Why start the business in the first place?
Well, I started the business somewhat out of necessity. I was a partner in another firm called Long Brown Associates, and it came to my attention in late 82 through a client of mine that my partner, who was the majority owner by a large extent, was making a lot of future plans for the company, for the partnership, and they didn't seem to include me in any way, shape, or form. And he outlined to me that I had a couple of choices. I could either leave on my own terms and my own timing, or I would be asked to leave at some future date. So I was going to looking at the possibility of being unemployed.
So you thought, what the heck, I'll start a company.
I did. In 1982, September of 82, was a recessionary year. It certainly was a recessionary year for the construction industry, which we're tied to very closely. And so there weren't a whole lot of opportunities anyway.
Right.
And a downtime, a recession time, is actually a great time to start a business. And I didn't know that at the time, but it turned out to be a wonderful time to start a business.
What were the early days like?
The early days were very, very tough and very difficult, and probably the most exciting time of my life. It was so much fun. The first employee I hired, I called him up and asked him to come and meet me at a restaurant, and the restaurant was closed. It had been burnt down, and he told me later, he said, I don't know why I came to work for you, because here you are, you didn't even have a company, you didn't have an office, you didn't have any money, and you invite me to a burned out restaurant. But for whatever reason, he signed on, and it was just, we had such a lot of fun. We worked hard. It was a challenge. But it was a lot of fun. Probably the most fun I've ever had, actually.
Yeah, was it tough getting customers?
It was not. Again, you don't need a lot of customers when you're one or two people. That's the good news. So you don't need a whole lot. I had a lot of good friends. I had a lot of contacts in the industry from having been in it for about 10 years at that time, and they found me. I had this one fellow. My very first client was a fellow named Stan Azrael, who ran a company called Alexandria Scrap Corporation, which doesn't sound too exotic, but he was a very, very exotic type guy. And he found me before I even had a company. He found me. I have no idea how he found me, and I asked him, and he said, well, I'm not going to tell you, but I found you, and I'd like you to do some work for me. So it finding customers to keep a small business going early on was not a problem.
The first time I ever heard someone say, a downturn's a good time to start a company. And we were in a prolonged downturn.
Correct.
Why is it such a good time?
The reason is because when times are really good, the clients, what are they looking for? They're looking for just get the job done as quickly as you can, because it's go, 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 go. You really need to have a mass to support the customers when times are really good. When times are tougher, they tend to go a little slower. They're looking much more for quality and personal service. And a small firm that's just getting started can provide that. Whereas in the boom times, they're not going to pay attention to that. They just want, right, do it now, do it for me. When can you get it done is all they're after.
So here we are 30 years later. You're a mature, correct, company. You've got infrastructure. You've been through probably a number of down cycles.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. What's this last one been like?
The worst one. 2009 was absolutely a horrible year for us. This was really the worst one. We've never experienced anything like that. We actually started down. We peaked in 2005, early 2006. Yeah. We didn't know it, but that's when we peaked. 7 was down. 8 bubbled up just a little bit, but then 9 fell off the rails. The phone actually just stopped ringing. Contracts that we had were canceled.
How scary was that for you?
Terribly scary.
How'd you get through it?
Well, you can't cut expenses quick enough,
yeah,
to match the cash flow. The cash flow is just drying up. People, right, either they're canceling contracts, and if you have bills out, they're not paying them. So you really just lose money so quickly. You can't see straight. It is scary. It is scary.
What prepared you to be able to handle it?
I don't know that. I mean, I had been through two other recessions, maybe even three. One was very mild. The 2001, 2002 recession was mild for us.
Yeah. So take us back, though, to the early days. Where are you from?
Well, I was born in England, mm-hmm. And I'm an immigrant. I'm an only child, but my family came to this country on the boat in steerage. Steerage was a little better than it was in the 1890s, but not much. And we landed in New York in 1953. I missed Ellis Island by about 4 months, but we still went through the same sort of operation of being checked.
Yeah, you tell a great story about one of your early experiences, and you came to this country when you were 8, right?
I was 8 years old.
So tell us about that moment in D.C.
Well, it was July of 1953, which is important to remember, July, and we came by car from New York down to Washington, and in those days, you entered, as actually you do today, come right down New York Avenue. And New York Avenue was put me into a place that is so very different than I had ever been before in my life, when I lived in England in 1953, there were no immigrants from Africa, there were no black people at all. New York Avenue Washington was very segregated. It was the population was all black. There were these huge bugs. It was the year of the 7-year locust. There were these huge bugs at about 2 or 3 inches long, hitting the windshield like crazy. There was no air conditioning anywhere. People were all out on the streets, and the car windows were all down. There was noise. It was 106 degrees, and I said, oh, my God, I literally didn't know where we had landed. It was just such a culture shock coming from cold, wet, rainy, cool, white England to this place.
Yeah.
Was your father a businessman?
No, my dad was an auto mechanic. He did have somewhat of an entrepreneurial skill. It was totally unsuccessful in England. He had his own shoe repair shop for a while. That didn't work out very well. But then he was an auto mechanic, and my mom was a hairdresser.
So he went across the Atlantic. You came here. That's pretty brave.
You know, it is. And one of the things that I feel very strongly about, and it's not supposed to be a political show, I guess, but, you know, immigration. And I'm an immigrant. And I think that if you open your shores to immigrants, you're getting brave people. You don't leave your safe, secure family environment in the country of your birth easily. You have to have something in you to do that. And I think that immigrants that will make that switch, not all of them, obviously, but a large proportion, are people that we should welcome.
That's a great observation. Thank you for that. So why civil engineering?
Civil engineering, in high school, I was a fairly decent student in high school. Mathematics, I was fairly strong in, and I asked somebody, what can I do to make some money, because financial security was the most important thing to me and my family. Coming here we came with $57 when we landed, and they said, well, you can, with math, you can either be a math teacher or a civil engineer, and civil engineers always have a job, so that was it.
Where did you learn how to run a business?
You know, I'm not 100% certain where, but my dad was a little entrepreneurial, not very successfully until later in his life. My mom was very fiscally conservative. My wife says I've got both genes. I'm fiscally conservative and entrepreneurial. As I've thought about it, I had a couple of businesses early on. I had a fish business when I was in high school. My dad and I started a car rental business when I was in college. Didn't go anywhere, I might add, but we started it. We tried.
What do you think you learned from it?
You know, you learn how to do a business. You learn that it's not easy. You learn that the most important thing to know is what you don't know.
Right.
And there's nobody can tell you what that is. You just have to do it. And hopefully you figure it out and you learn from your mistakes. It's sort of a cliche, but it's so true. You make mistakes and you learn from it and you move forward.
Is your father aware of your success?
You know, both of my parents have passed away, unfortunately. My dad was aware of my success. My mom was too. She preceded my father.
If I were interviewing them, would they be surprised?
I don't think so, but I don't think they would.
Yeah, if they were here, what would you like to say to them?
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so very much for what you did for me.
Yeah. What's your proudest moment up till now?
You know, I think I am proudest of of surviving, starting the company and surviving for 30 years and providing employment to so many people. I had somebody tell me once about, you know, I said, gee, I think I should be doing more in this area, in that area. They said, look, you're providing gainful employment for 100 and something people with their families, and you should be proud of that. And
great.
I am.
Great. What's the website address, Chris?
It's Christopher Consultants, www.christopherconsultants.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Chris Brown, who's the founder and chairman of Christopher Consultants. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Alera, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is
Mike Harden.
Mike, who are you with?
I'm with Vistage International.
What is Vistage?
Vistage is by far the largest and probably the most prestigious organization of CEOs in the world. We have about 15,000 members in 16 different countries.
And what does Vistage do?
Vistage is there specifically to help people get better at what they do at the CEO level. Our goal is to help CEOs become better decision makers, to grow their businesses, to do more with what they've got.
And what do you do at Vistage?
Well, I'm a chair with Vistage, and a chair simply means that I chair a local group of chief executive officers, and I coach each of those people individually and try to make myself available to help them with their business needs.
Why is coaching so important to a CEO? Don't they have it all figured out?
I wish they did. I'd been a CEO myself for a long time, and I wish I'd had a coach. There's just too much going on in today's world. You're being pulled in all kinds of different directions. You're making decisions every day, and it's just so isolated for some people to have to make those decisions without the ability to go to other people.
There's a plethora of coaches out there. Why are you a fantastic CEO coach? Why you?
Well, I would say that what I do is I help good CEOs become great CEOs, and what I do with that is I have certain axioms of business that I try to stress, and one of the first ones is that you deserve the people that you hire and keep.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, if you have A players on your staff, they're going to do a great job for you, and you deserve to have them. If you have B players, well, then you deserve to have B players.
So you're looking for what type of person?
I look for CEOs who are lifelong learners who want to be better at what they do and need someone like me to help them get there.
How do we find you, Mike?
Well, I have a blog, and most CEOs look at it. It's called CEOSuccessCoach.com.
We've been speaking with Mike Harden of Vistage and CEOSuccessCoach.com. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Alera, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. We're broadcasting today from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Mike Primo, who's the president and CEO of an organization called the Airlines Reporting Corporation. What is the Airlines Reporting Corporation, Mike?
Well, we're the financial settlement connection between 193 airlines and about 14,000 travel agencies.
Financial settlement connection, what does that mean?
That means when you buy a ticket from a travel agent, whether it's a mom-and-pop travel agency down the street or Expedia, we make sure the airline gets the money.
How long has this organization been around?
We were originally part of the Air Transport Association, now known as Airlines for America, and our roots go back deep into time. The settlement system itself that I talked about started in 1964, and our company was established in 1985 when we were spun off at the end of airline regulation.
Okay. How big or small is the organization today?
382 people, but we're big in scope. We, as I said, connect hundreds of airlines and thousands of travel agencies. About 140 million airline tickets flow through our system, about $80 billion worth of sales activity.
Wow. And when did you become the president and CEO?
Just about a year ago.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Why are you were the ideal pick at this point in time?
I think that as the board was looking for a CEO, they were impressed by my background, having worked both for airlines and for travel agencies.
And what made that important?
Well, that's the nature of our business. We're what my former boss used to call a compromise organization. Nobody ever gets 100% of what they want in this kind of a setup. So we're not quite an association. We do some of the sorts of things that associations do. But we do have to keep in mind both the interests of both parties, or else the system really doesn't work.
And you're very good at this.
Well, I'd like to think that I am. I hope my board thinks that I am.
But that's a heck of a skill. Where did this first start to show up?
I think, you know, as a young person, I'm small of stature. You can't tell on the radio, but I'm only, 5'5 or so, and was never the biggest kid in the neighborhood. So you sort of have to learn to live by your wits. And that means learning how to deal with people, learning how to manage difficult, challenging situations, how to talk the bully out of beating you up, how to talk the bully out of beating up your brother. So I guess I picked up some good negotiating and mediation skills along the way as a result of that.
That's interesting. Where are you from?
Grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, cold country.
And what was that like?
Other than cold?
Yeah. What was going on when you were a youngster that kind of shaped who you are today, in addition to
My dad was an educator. We were a middle-class kind of family, so grew up with the neighborhood kids playing on the streets and in the parks in the suburban Minneapolis area. Was a Boy Scout. My dad was one of the leaders in the Boy Scout organization and got some, I think, good leadership experience.
Tell us about that. What, looking back on it, how do you think why was it a good decision to be in the Boy Scouts?
My original interest was my dad actually had been one and had left an old Boy Scout handbook around the house. And so looking at things, going outdoors and learning how to tie knots and cook your own food over a campfire and the achievement aspects of it as well, get some merit badges and kind of get promoted in the ranks all sort of appealed to me. It wasn't until later on when I became a patrol leader and a leader of the troop that I realized how difficult leadership really is. Trying to get kids that are you're maybe 13 and you're trying to get 11 and 12 year olds to do what you want to do. You've got to start thinking a little differently and lead by both example as well as persuasion.
Did you like it?
I guess I did, yes. I liked the fact that you could accomplish things by getting a team of people together and looking back on saying, hey, look, we did this.
So you went off to college. What did you major in?
I was a theater major, actually. I started off as a chemistry major, and I don't think my parents were too thrilled when I came home one day and said, I really don't like this chemistry thing. I think I want to be a theater major.
And looking back on that, was that a good decision?
Steve Jobs, in his commencement at Stanford, said everything happens for a reason, and I think theater happened to me for a reason. And I don't think I really appreciated the time. A lot of people think, of course, of the public speaking skills that comes along with it, but it's a much more practical major than that. I learned how to weld as part of set construction. I learned about lighting and electricity. I learned carpentry. I learned about clothing and costume and history as a result of that. And of course, directing is really management and leadership 101. You get a script and you get a date certain that you have to have the show open, and you've got to hire and you've got a plan, and you've got to work with a team of your stage manager and your set designer and your lighting designer to bring everything together and advertise and promote. You got to do signs and sell tickets, and so it's a great management training program for someone who's 20 years old to put a team together and actually accomplish something interesting and meaningful.
Well, you're in technology and airlines. I can't think of two areas that have changed more since 1964 or 65. What taught you to deal with this change and pace of change?
You really learn that quickly when you're in the airline business. Maybe starting in the front lines and reservations helped me adapt to that kind of environment very quickly. I joined just about the time deregulation was happening, and all of a sudden, instead of having three fares in a market, we had hundreds of fares in a market, and they were changing constantly. And so I guess I grew up just thinking that was normal. And the pace of change in this industry has continued to be rapid to this day. So that sort of operating tempo and change management becomes, I think, sort of second nature to the folks that are in this business.
How did you get into the airline industry?
I was fortunate. I was, came out of college without any particular job prospects. Minneapolis has a nice theater community, but it tends to be more amateur than professional. And we had two hometown airlines at the time, Northwest Airlines and North Central, and I applied for jobs at both and ended up getting on in reservations at Northwest.
What do you like most about this industry?
Well, I I think it really is the change. You know, it's the opportunity to impact in a good way the quality of life for the 193 airlines that we represent, the 14,000 travel agencies that do business through us, and the literally millions of customers that use the services of both of those entities.
So where did you learn the business of running a business, other than the theater, when you got into the airline industry? Talk about your progression over time.
So, I was in reservations, actually got recruited, sort of forgot about it, actually. A manager of the department was kind of he liked to pick through the top talent that was in the various reservation classes. And I went to, he came forward one day and said, you know, I'd like you to think about working in our department. So at that time, we were a unionized organization. I put a letter in saying I was interested. Months went by, forgot all about it, and one day said, well, your transfer came through. So I started working in the yield management, learning how to overbook flights. And that gave me a little bit more exposure to the airline, the way we operate, because you work with flight operations about, you know, should we hold a flight for connections, or working with different aspects of that business. But he was you learn about managing a business by learning from your managers, whatever aspect of the business that they're working in. And Northwest was a very tough culture. You know, in reservations, we had to turn in our pencil stubs in order to get a new one. There were no doors on the men's room stalls because the CEO didn't want people loitering in the restrooms. And so, but the manager of this department was a really great human being, had a great sense of humor, let us operate the shop much more holistically and with a lot more flexibility than a lot of the rest of the company. And so I learned something from that experience about, right, you know, how do you motivate a team of people? How do you get them to do things, make a commitment to your organization? You got to make a commitment back to them.
Yeah. How would you characterize your leadership style?
You know, I'm very direct. You know, I like to spell out for people what I like and don't like. I've become un-Midwestern in that way. As I was dealing with East Coast clients, I really developed an appreciation for them because people in Minnesota are so nice. You know, that one day they're being nice to you, and the next week you'd find out you lost the account because they just were too nice to tell you that they weren't happy with what you were doing. So when I got some temporary work for a company I was working for out in Philadelphia and started working with the East Coast clients, and boy, they let you know right away. You know, I don't like this and I don't like that, and you guys are messing up. So, but you'd fix it, and they'd be, okay, that's great. Let's, you know, I got two more things, but, you know, that's good. So I like that kind of directness and feedback. And as I've gotten older, I've tried to become more courageous as a manager and as a leader, and to you know, people aren't always going to like what you say.
Yeah,
but
courageous is an interesting word. When you say that, give us an example of what that would look like.
You know, one of the things that I've done as CEO is sort of at the request of some of the employees is do regular town hall meetings, where, you know, the employees put up a topic that they want to hear about, and so I get up and I lay it out for them, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And they don't always like everything that I have to say, but they like the fact that they're hearing it straight from the top. They like hearing what I believe in and what I don't believe in, and how my, you know, give you a concrete example. We just did a program to reinstate an element of our 401k program that really benefits longer-term employees rather than the newer people, because it's a combination of years of service and age that gets a payout. Right. So we put that back in place, but I told them that this benefits the older employees, but we do have and are going to have programs that benefit all the younger employees. Right. And the older employees aren't going to like that.
Yeah.
But
And what's the website address, Mike?
ARCCorp.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Mike Primo, who is the President and CEO of Airlines Reporting Corporation. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Allaire, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
Tonight
is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses, and a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380 or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, along with my co-host, Ed Allaire, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. We're broadcasting today from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Dan Frank, who's the CEO and managing partner of a company called Three Wire Systems. What is Three Wire Systems, Dan?
Three Wire Systems is a company that specializes in providing proactive preventative care to military veterans.
Say a little more about that. What does that mean?
Sure. So we've been doing this work for over 5 years, and we found that veterans, when they reintegrate into society, generally need help in four key areas. Those are behavioral health, careers, finances, and wellness. And we define wellness as things such as sleep quality, sleep hygiene, physical activity, weight management, medication adherence, and smoking cessation.
And when was the company started?
We started the company in 2006.
How big or small are you today?
We're about 80 people. We have an office in Falls Church, Virginia, and we have our Vet Operations Center near Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
And why did you start this company?
It was really a fortuitous set of events. When I started Three Wire, we concentrated in IT solutions to the federal government, which we actually still do today. But shortly after starting the company, we had an opportunity to bid on a contract to provide veteran outreach and veteran behavioral health services. And I was approached by a partner company, and they asked if I was interested in joining them on the bid, and I said, sure. Didn't know a whole lot about that type of business, but it intrigued me. Being a vet, I wanted to give back. So we bid and subsequently won, and here we are today.
Yeah. Was that a great decision, looking back on it?
It was an excellent decision looking back. It was one of those things that I said to myself, I've got other fish to fry and places to concentrate. And one of the rules in entrepreneurship is focus. But I guess I broke that rule and it worked for me.
Great. And so you're new to the entrepreneurial side of the spectrum.
Somewhat new. When somebody said I'd been in this a while, I said, no, I haven't. And then I thought back, and it's been almost 10 years. As I am fond of saying, I rose to my political level of incompetency once I was out of the Navy, and I had been working for large firms, software firms. Didn't enjoy it, and decided I needed to do something different. So I was in California, and I first started consulting to learn a little bit about getting out on my own. And then I had a friend that was involved in federal contracting on the East Coast, and he had told me about some different types of programs, such as the Disabled Veteran Business Program,
right.
And I thought I would be a good fit for that. I then subsequently started doing some work with a firm that I started in California, and quickly learned that California really isn't the place to be to start a federal business.
Right. You have this great line as you characterize the business you're in as having a double bottom line. What do you mean by that?
So I didn't invent that term, but I heard it and I love it, because what it the implications of it are is that we can make money and we can give back at the same time. So whereas we're a for-profit company, I really feel that we're doing a lot of good stuff around nonprofit type of intentions.
Right.
Well, you're a Navy aviator.
Correct,
and
former.
That's former Navy aviator. That's a single-person operation as a pilot, at least the flying part. How did that prepare you to be an entrepreneur leader?
I think aviation can prepare somebody to be an entrepreneur in that a lot of planning, a lot of analytical work about thinking through problems, systems, what you need to accomplish a mission. Certainly prepares emergency procedures. And what do you do when something goes wrong? Always having a plan B. So I think that by virtue of that type of training and just my personality in general kind of melded. I don't think at this point in my life, I really don't think entrepreneurial skills can be taught in school. I think you just have to go out there and do it and fail and learn and pick yourself up and move on.
When did you know you wanted to be a pilot?
I can remember back when I was about 8 years old. It always fascinated me. Always wanted to look at books about airplanes, learn about how they worked, learned about airports. My dad did a lot of traveling. In fact, I have a plaque from United Airlines. It's actually made out of wood from 1962 when he did 100,000 miles in 1 year. So that was the first of the frequent flyer awards. And it's amazing if you think about it. That was mostly prop.
Right.
Prop type aircraft, and so he's bouncing around over 100,000 miles in 12 months. That must have been painful.
So why go military, not commercial?
Just the allure of carrier aviation really appealed to me. I thought that those guys were the hottest in the air, and I wanted to be one of them.
Where are you from?
I was born in Los Angeles, but grew up in a number of places, Bethesda, Maryland, New Jersey, and back to California for high school and subsequently college.
What were Mom and Dad doing?
My father was an entrepreneur. He got his training in the military. He was a draftee in Korea, a private first class in the Army who was destined for Korea, and was a mathematician and had a mathematics degree, and the Army came looking for mathematicians to help program the first set of analog computers, and so he was recruited into that. Subsequent to that, he then worked for TRW and then broke off with a couple of partners and started their own first independent software vendor called Informatics back in 1961 or 62. At the time, my mom was a housewife, although she had a degree in art. And then as the kids got older, she exited the mom business and started doing licensed clinical social work type of work.
Your father is an immigrant, I think you said?
Yes, my dad was an immigrant from Germany, came over here in about 1938 when he was about 8 years old. Landed at Ellis Island, a classic story of losing everything in Germany and then making well, doing good, pulled himself up by his bootstrap and founded companies and did great things.
So how do you suppose that shaped you, all of this family history?
That's a good question. As I get older, I think I reflect on it more. Growing up, you know, he was just dad doing his thing. Always seemed to provide for the family, and we were kind of on that that social climb.
Upward mobile.
Upward mobile, there we go. That upward mobile climb. It all appeared relatively normal to me because I didn't know anything else. It wasn't until I got out of the military and started working that I really appreciated what he had done with his life. And I guess in some sense trying to emulate it.
Yeah. What was the biggest surprise to you when you transitioned out of the military into the private sector?
The biggest surprise is probably the slow pace and the bureaucracy that companies run within. I ended up at a consulting firm, KPMG. It was a great first job. I was there 3 years right after the military. But compared to I left an operational squadron, a carrier-based squadron, and ended up in civilian life. So there was quite a set of things I had to learn about how to negotiate working within a company like that.
What was it like to lead in the private sector as opposed to the military?
Right. Well, in the military, as everybody knows, it's a command and control functions, command and control model. I think, though, that most people think that the military is somebody tells you what to do and you do it, and that is correct to some extent. But once you're when you're in an operational squadron and you're trying to accomplish a mission, rank sometimes does go out the window, and you do what you have to do to get it done. But however, in the military, you're not really thinking a lot about people's personality and how best to approach them to get your idea or your vision done, because again, it's more oriented and predicated on command and control. In the civilian side, in the private sector, I've noted in my Vistage work has helped me, which is a CEO peer group that I meet with once a month, that people are different. People have different personalities, and that there's four primary different personalities. And when I think about how to articulate a vision and then what we need to do to accomplish it, that has to be sold in four different ways. And so I'm endeavor to do that.
Right.
Your veterans' work,
yes,
is very sophisticated and intricate. How do you deal with that? How did you learn to build it and lead those people?
Everything that I've learned to date has just been on-the-job training. I don't have really a technical background. So, you know, as a common saying is, surround yourself with people that fill the voids. And so that's what I've done. It's really about, I think, generating ideas, good ideas, selling those ideas, and then constantly laying the road in front of you. So we may not have all the assets that we need to bring the innovation to bear, but we know we can do it. You have to have a positive attitude, and so we always know that we can lay the road in front of us to bring to bear what our ideas are.
What do you like most about the work that you do today?
I think the great thing about the work today is that I can get up in the morning, look at myself, and think about who I'm going to help. Now, I never actually see those people. I shouldn't say never. I rarely see the end user of my product, of our company's product. My coaches, on the other hand, do. We'll have over 50,000 contacts with veterans this year. So our coaches from our coaching facility will talk, chat, work in web portals, and sometimes in cases face-to-face with veterans. So at the end of the day, I can go home and know that we've accomplished something that this country needs. You know, as I say, many people outside the Beltway don't know a lot about the veterans and what are happening. They may read some headlines. But we should be outraged. Anytime you see a homeless vet or a vet that can't pick up a job, you should be outraged about that. There's got to be a solution. I think we're working on those solutions and bringing them to bear to take down veteran unemployment to respectable levels and to eliminate homelessness.
How do you know you have somebody who's interviewing, when someone's interviewing you with you for the company, how do you know you want to hire that person?
That's a great question. I was a believer of gut feel, but I've been burned on that a number of times. So nowadays, we have a much more structured process. We actually do behavioral testing. We have multiple interviews. What it really comes down to is, can we feel the person's passion to help what we need to do to accomplish our mission?
Great.
That's where it comes to.
What's the website address, Dan?
www.threewire, threewire, sys, like system, but just sys, sys.com.
Thank you.
threewiresys.com.
Wonderful. We've been speaking with Dan Frank, who's the CEO and managing partner of Threewire Systems. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Allaire with Buchanan Ingersoll and Rooney, for helping with the interviews today. We've had a great lineup of guests, including Susan Neely, who's the president and CEO of the American Broadcaster Beverage Association. I'm sorry, the American Beverage Association. Chris Brown, founder and chairman of Christopher Consultants. Mike Primo, the president and CEO of Airlines Reporting Corporation. And finally, Dan Frank, who's the CEO and managing partner of Threewire Systems. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. And I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a show. This is Peter Schwartz. Signing off. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements.